Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes our pets so precious? The industry that caters to household animal companions rakes in about $43 billion a year in the United States and now comprises sectors including daycare, organic food, spa services, and psychopharmaceuticals. So why do we find it so easy to pony up to pamper our pets, and what do we believe we're getting in return? Writer Michael Schaefer explores America's love affair with animals in his new book, One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
We should start by explaining, if you will excuse the horrible pun, that you have a dog in this fight yourself.
Yes.
A St. Bernard that you picked up at a shelter.
That's right. And, you know, I remember it was a few years ago when my wife and I were going out to get him from the shelter, and we were driving along and we were saying to each other, you know, we're never going to do this and we're never going to do that. And we're not going to be like those people. Cause, you know, I think everyone has read or sees these media stories about all those crazy people out there doing insane, over-the-top things for their pets. And we were determined, promising that we would not become like them. And you know, we brought him home, and I think I don't need to tell anyone out there who has a pet that it just gets a little more complicated than that. I don't think we have actually become crazy people. He doesn't have a tutu or anything like that, although he is a St. Bernard, and I don't think they come in his size. But, you know, over the next few months, as we got accustomed to living with him, I mean, there were just things that we were doing. I'd never had a dog before, so I was just sort of watching people in the neighborhood, friends and so on, and kind of doing what they did, assuming that that was just the basic, responsible, good thing to do as an owner of a pet. You know, we got him pretty decent food, and he had a lot of trouble adjusting to not living in a shelter anymore. He'd been in a shelter for most of his 18 months of life, and apparently, according to our vet, that's a pretty common condition. And one of the things you can do to help manage it is there is a pill for that. In fact, it's the same antidepressant medication as you or I might take. It's an SSRI, and the only difference is it's beef flavored. So we're doing all, you know, things like that, and getting, you know, chew toys that promise to keep him entertained and so on during our long absences from the home. And my family is kind of looking at us and rolling their eyes and, you know, thinking, boy, you guys have really gone nuts over this. And to my mind, you know, these are nice people. They're not people who hate pets or anything like that. To my mind, what had happened is that the definition of what normal is had changed quite a lot between when they got pets and when we did. And as a reporter, you know, I think when the definition of normal changes so fast, that's an indication that something interesting is going on.
It's so interesting. You know, I think growing up, I had a girlfriend whose parents had a St. Bernard, and it was a much-loved dog, but it lived outside in a doghouse and sort of wasn't allowed to tramp through. And nowadays, most people who have pets wouldn't think of keeping their dogs in the yard all the time.
No, and you mean you'd be liable to get a lecture from someone who says that, you know, who would point out accurately that pets are social. Dogs particularly are social creatures and benefit from human company. I think people would worry about the liability of, you know, what if it got out of the backyard. There's all kinds of reasons why, but, I mean, really, when was the last time you saw a doghouse that was actually in use housing dogs?
Yeah, usually the kids are playing in them or something.
Right. And instead, pets, you know, live in the home with us. And, you know, people ask, boy, isn't it crazy that we spend $2 billion a year as a country on pet grooming? But it's actually a lot less crazy if you think about where they sleep. In some surveys, half of people say their pet actually sleeps in their bed. And you're going to be a lot more concerned about the smell emanating from someone who's at the foot of your bed than from someone who's sleeping in a house in the backyard.
Yeah, you write that when you got Murphy, your St. Bernard, he had a stench somewhere between warm bunion and rotten tripe.
Right, that may actually be positive. It may actually be a compliment. You know, he'd had a rough time. We're not 100% sure what the backstory is, but he was only 63 pounds, and he's a St. Bernard. They're supposed to grow to, you know, 150, 180 pounds.
Wow.
He's 100 now, so he's small, and maybe it was the runt of a litter, and I suspect that's why he wound up in a shelter, that someone had been breeding dogs and, you know, realized they had a kind of malfunctioning product on their hand, mm-hmm. as cruel as that may sound. He's great for us, and, you know, has really sort of come to be a full part of our family, and it's, you know, one of these things where I realize that's just the way we live now. I don't think there's anything particularly unique about me or particularly smitten about me. I think the change in how we treat pets and all of this boom in spending and so on really can be traced back to this promotion that we've given them. It's, if you go to an old pet cemetery and you look at the gravestones, some of the cemeteries on the East Coast are 100 years old, and the oldest of the headstones will say, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant. And you come a little bit into the 20th century, and that is replaced with, here lies Fido, man's best friend. I mean, if you look at the newest of them, from the last 10 or 20 years, you see a lot of kind of mommy and daddy miss you and our little girl and that sort of stuff. And they're not named Fido anymore either. Their names are more likely to be, you know, Jake and Max and the kind of names that get thrown around my daughter's preschool playground.
Yeah, who did you have first, your daughter or Murphy?
We had the dog first.
Yeah.
People had actually warned us, you know, you may really be centered on that dog now, but things sure are going to change when you have a kid come along. And it's been, you know, like anything, when you have a child, it gets more complicated. But she really loves him, and it's kind of a wonderful thing to watch.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Over and over in your research, you do find this, that people don't think of themselves anymore as pet owners, but as pet parents.
Right. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of legal stuff around these terms, and particularly around the use of the term guardian and what it conveys about one's responsibilities. But I think, you know, leaving aside the legal mumbo-jumbo, there is this sense that these animals are a member of the family. And once you've kind of accepted that, as I think most people probably have, then, you know, all of a sudden all these other decisions that were kind of afterthoughts suddenly become quite fraught. And it's sort of, well, what kind of food should I get? And instead of it being, well, he's a dog, he'll eat anything, what's the cheapest thing at the Safeway, it's, you know, what do I owe the dog in terms of my responsibility for its nutrition and its well-being? I think even the most smitten pet people don't think that their dog is a gourmand, but you see what's happening with pet food is exactly the same thing as has happened with human food. Whereas most of us once just sort of got what was there at Safeway. Now we are a fairly diverse and divided country where some people are going to Walmart and some people are going to Whole Foods and some people are sort of going off the grid to the farmer's market. And you see the exact same thing in pet food, and for the same reasons, which is that people are kind of playing out their views about nutrition and well-being and their suspicions about agribusinesses and so on in their shopping decisions for something as seemingly inconsequential as their dog's food.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned agribusiness, because another thing that you sort of talk about is this idea that, you know, over the past century, most of us who might have previously had contact with animals for slaughter really don't have that anymore. So many of us live in cities, and we've never known pets as anything other than pets.
Right, and you know, 100 years ago, the idea of having a pet was a pretty radical idea. The economist Thorstein Veblen, who coined the term conspicuous consumption, he sort of thought of pets as the ultimate example of that, because this was at a time when people were making their children work in factories, and the idea that you would have an animal that didn't have to do anything in exchange for being fed, other than sit there and love you, was quite radical. And at that time, most people who lived in urban areas, even if they weren't living on the farm anymore, they would see, you know, horses pulling carts. They would see the kind of other roles of animals not as pets, but as labor and as servants. And they would see the kind of life cycle. They would see death. They would see pain. They would sort of have to come to understand that's just sort of part of the world. And I think nowadays, for the great many of us Americans, we don't see animals doing anything else other than being pets. You know, yeah, we might see a police horse every now and then, or if you know, depending on your interests, a few other things. But for the most part, we're removed from that cycle and quite sensitive to it. So the idea that, you know, your dog might just die or might get a disease and you would decide not to invest in fixing that disease is kind of anathema to people, and it makes people very uncomfortable. And what sort of person am I that I wouldn't try to? I mean, my dog has cataracts, say. We can get them fixed. I know my Aunt Mabel had her cataracts fixed. And I think people kind of go through that calculation and have a harder time sort of saying to themselves, well, look, a dog is different from my Aunt Mabel.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting now even that we see this growing number of veterinary specialists, not just in the past where we'd have, you know, they'd focus on a species of animal, but now they're actually specializing in particular conditions that animals have.
Right, and, you know, it's really kind of reflected the change in human medicine. But you know, as their customer base becomes increasingly pet people who will say, hey, vet, do you know someone who can look at my dog's heart condition? And sure enough, there's a veterinary cardiologist and oncologists and arthroscopic surgeons and all sorts of things that didn't used to exist. I mean, the veterinary profession, which used to be heavily focused on agriculture, nowadays, heavily agricultural states are actually offering various incentives. Please come to our areas because we can't find enough agricultural vets. While vets who work in metropolitan areas where most of their patients are going to be pets, that is a very well-subscribed and very recession-resistant profession.
Michael Schaefer is my guest. We're talking about his new book, One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. We'd love to know what you think. Give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We want to take a break now to ask you to support KERA, and the producer of this show, Think, Jeff Whittington, is with us. He's also the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know on Fridays. And Jeff, we have copies of Michael's book.
We do. They're available when you join the station at the $120 membership level. You get your very own copy of One Nation Under Dog. And I got to tell you, Chris, when this came across through my inbox, I immediately said, our audience will love this. And we're actually all, you know, several of us here are pet owners. We're all listening, you know, and want to get back to the interview as quickly as possible. We're really hoping that you will call right now, 800-456-5372, or go online to kera.org. There is a building momentum here, and we did make a challenge in the last hour. Thanks so much to Mary Lou and Will Smith for their generous contribution and that challenge. And thanks to all of you for calling. But we're still waiting to hear from you. We're still waiting to hear from Think fans. It's your very first chance as a Think listener to support the station during this membership campaign, so please call now.
Yeah, we are always so grateful when those of you who listen faithfully to the show give us a call. We know there are some among you who every time we have a drive will make a contribution. I think my parents are among that number. And if you do that this time, if you're already a member in good standing but you want to make an additional gift, we want you to know that everyone who either goes online or calls to make a donation during this drive does have a chance to be enrolled in the, what are we calling it, a drawing, not a sweepstakes, a drawing for this amazing trip to London.
Drawing.
Yes. This trip to London. Well, I guess you can say that.
Watch
all
out.
Of our British listeners, please forgive that. a drawing so that you can take this trip to London. You get a $1,000 Marriott gift card to pay for your accommodations. And you will get a tour of the BBC studios, which I think sounds like so much fun.
I think the seats are business class seats on British Airways.
Nice.
I would just stay, just sit in those seats for a week in London and just stay in that. You know, I'll just stay here, thanks. But yeah, it's a pretty great deal. Go online to kera.org or call to get yourself entered in that drawing. And, you know, it's hopefully it's the programming that you hear every day on KERA and especially this show, Think, that Chris and I work on with some other great team members, that we really hope that you'll support it right now at 800-456-5372.
Want to say thanks to folks like Shubra Nandi in Fort Worth, Rachel Buckley in Colleyville, and anyone else who is on the line right now. Remember, you can also go online to kera.org and make your contribution. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can pick up a copy of Michael Schaefer's book as our thank you with a $120 contribution, or you can go to kera.org, click on the support button. It's right up there at the top of the page. It'll take you right there, and you can become the next new or renewing member of KERA, or you can make an additional gift and also get yourself signed up potentially for this drawing, which is going to be amazing. Give us a call right now, please. 1-800-456-5372 or go to kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Michael Schaefer is my guest. His new book is called One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. If you think that you would like to have a copy of Michael's book and you are ready to support KERA, we can put those things together conveniently for you with one phone call or one trip to the web. You can call 1-800-456-5372 or click the support button at KERA.org. Make a $120 contribution, pay for it however it's convenient for you, and you will both support the station, and you can choose as your thank you gift a copy of Michael's book. If you want to join our discussion, tell us what you think about all this new attention that we're paying to our pets in America. You can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Michael, we were talking about veterinarians. I wonder, aside from the fact that their jobs are steadier than ever if they're working in a city practice that caters to pets, whether they're ever conflicted about the care, the ongoing care they're asked to provide for animals, as opposed to the choice that might have been easier, say, 20 years ago, to euthanize an animal who's very ill.
Well, you know, I think that I spent a week following a vet in Philadelphia who is an innovator in these sort of minimally invasive surgeries that let him sort of go in Fantastic Voyage style with these little tubes to kind of open up occluded passages that may have been blocked by cancers and so on. And one of the things that we watched this incredible surgery, we were all in our kind of space suits in this watching a fluoroscope, which is like a real-time x-ray machine, do its thing. And the doctor, just from outside the dog's body, kind of manipulating these guide wires through the body. And the purpose was to deploy a stent which would keep open a passageway that was being blocked by a cancer. And it was a lot of expense for the owner and a great deal of effort for these two highly skilled surgeons and their entire team. I mean, this is how big a deal it is that these guys are. The next week, they were going off to lecture to human radiologists about some of the stuff they'd picked up, the human medicine radiologists.
Huh.
So we watched this whole thing happen. It's incredibly cool and impressive. And at the end of it, he's like, you know, this dog's still going to die from cancer. This whole thing was palliative. The tumor that had been blocking the passageway is still going to grow and eventually going to kill the dog. But he will be able to, this was near his kidney, and he would still be able to expel waste as a result of what they had done, which would give him many more months. And, you know, and I said, what, this whole thing was palliative, all this work you've just done? And he said, yeah. And, you know, for some people, an extra year with their pet, an extra 9 months with their pet, and you can calculate that in dog years, is worth every expense. I had watched him as he met with clients, and he would go over how much it was going to cost them and what it was likely to result in, both in terms of the benefits and in terms of how much stress and pain and displeasure it would leave for the pet. So, you know, I feel like he did what he could in terms of making a very clear case to people about what it was they were getting and what it was it was going to cost. But I think for a lot of the people, at least the people who had made their way that far to this veterinary hospital, you know, it was worth any expense.
You know, it's interesting because reading your book, I don't think of myself as a crazy pet person either. But when we first got our dog, who is quite old now, we were having her spayed and her little heart stopped on the operating table. And it ended up costing, you know, $1,200 for this $30 pound dog. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how things change when it's your pet. You may look
right
at other people and think they're ridiculous. But somehow when it's an animal that you have attached yourself to,
right,
it's much harder to make these cut and dry decisions.
Right. And it's you know, people, I spent a few months going to a pet loss bereavement group. It met every Tuesday night, and I remember thinking beforehand, you know, this is really going to be it. This is going to be a bunch of people who kind of need to get a life. And it was one of the saddest things I've ever done. Mm-hmm. You know, and as a reporter, I had covered, you know, I covered war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and I covered murders and fires and stuff. And for whatever reason, this really, really got to me. The people felt so devastated, and one of the things they felt also was that they were very alone in their grief, that you know, if an actual family member dies, a human family member dies, your office will say, hey, you know, take as much time off as you need, or maybe your coworkers will take up a collection and that sort of thing. But when it's a pet, there's a lot of like, hey, we'll get another one. And that was not obviously something that these folks were able to hear at that point. And so they felt not only devastated, but also kind of isolated and like their grief was somehow not legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it to be very touching. I mean, these people had established really close relationships with their pets. I mean, you can say that maybe speaks to something else that was wrong with their lives, but that's not really, I don't think, for us to judge. I think as it happened, their lives were very enriched by their pets, and they were very devastated when they passed.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because another thing that I thought was really interesting was this idea of, we'll get in a minute to the question of actual social networking online for pets,
right.
but this sense that people use their pets as they're walking through the neighborhood or the dog park or somewhere to sort of break the ice and help them form more robust human relationships.
Right. You know, I mean, it's one of the theories about what is going on with pets is that if you look at the pet population, it grew at about the same rate as the human population for many years, and it started to grow much faster than the human population starting in the 70s. Same time as divorce increased, it became much easier to move farther from your family. People left kind of tight-knit old neighborhoods behind and established a sort of different, maybe more isolated mode of living in sprawling communities. And kind of to... People had always had pets and loved their pets, but they leaned on them for more and to kind of make up for some of the human companionship and human social support they had lost. And I think you really see that as a motivation for people promoting their pets to a kind of newer place of importance in their lives. One of the things that does, though, is that people are very attuned to their pets. You find that bringing people together in strange ways, some of them quite predictable, like if you go to the dog park every day, it's only logical that you're going to take the time to converse with the other humans that are there, and maybe that you'll even become friends, as well as people getting together in these sort of dog groups. I spent a bunch of time, it was really funny, visiting with the New York City Chihuahua meetup group, people they would have these events. They'd have a Christmas party and a Halloween party, and they'd all dress up their dogs and gather and have doggy ice cream and doggy cake and also, you know, human mimosas and sandwiches and stuff. And these were people who, it was in New York, and it's hard enough to meet people. And they had, for you know, we can judge it if we want, but they had used their interest in their own very small dogs to sort of establish human bonds and friendships and companionship, and I think it was a very sweet thing.
Do you think there's also something at work here with regard to the way we are marketed to about our pets? Because obviously there are people out there making huge amounts of money selling dog dresses and dog toenail polish and, you know, any number of things. Has that also changed the way we think?
I think so. I mean, you know, there's always a chicken and egg question with any marketing thing about what was there first, the emotion or the advertisement catering to the emotion. But you know, when big pet pharmaceutical companies have websites called petparents.com, or when advertisers are saying, you know, as a pet parent, you owe it to your dog to do blank. I think that maybe appeals to the people who already think of themselves as pet parents, but to people who might not, I think there's a feeling of, boy, is there something wrong with me? Maybe I'm failing in my duty to this animal that needs me. You know, so it's a complicated thing with marketing, and they certainly push it. And like anyone selling any product, playing to the emotions works.
Do we have any evidence that dogs and cats and parakeets and bearded dragons actually appreciate being dressed up in clothing or fed organic food?
I think dressed up in clothing, I suspect the evidence is to the contrary, at least, at least in my dog's case. I don't know that they mind it a great deal. But as far as food goes, I mean, to judge at least from my dog and from most of the dogs I've ever encountered, you know, they'll eat anything. They'd be happy to eat stuff out of the garbage. That's dogs for you. But do they benefit in terms of healthier life and so on? The evidence is mostly towards yes. There are some diets that are, you know, people really, really subscribe to that actually aren't endorsed by nutritionists because they aren't balanced diets. But in terms of your basic sort of, if you take a step up from the generic to something organic or something healthier, yeah, I think that over the course of a long lifespan, that probably is a benefit. Just like any food change, it's
there are fetishists who are going to think it's a night and day kind of difference, and I don't think that's true. But certainly it's a plus. It's just not a plus on the taste side necessarily. It's a plus on the health side.
Can you talk a little bit about social networking for animals?
Right. There are these websites, just the same way as there's Facebook and so on. There are pet social networking websites like Dogster. People put up a picture of their dog, link to dogs they're friends with, and so on. And it's a sort of another way that pets kind of, these pet people come together. And in more informal ways, I remember I spent a week in Austin while I was reporting this book. I was visiting with a company that manufactures these very elaborate chew toys. Mm-hmm. And I was walking back to my hotel at night, and I passed this bar, sort of an outdoor place, and there was a sign that said, "Tonight, Yappy Hour." I went in. They'd put out some dog bowls and some biscuits and stuff, and it was a bunch of people who maybe at that time in the evening would ordinarily be walking their dogs, and this time instead of taking a solo walk, they brought their dogs someplace and were interacting with other humans. And for the bar, it was a smart move. It was, I don't remember what night of the week it was, but it was one of the quiet nights of the week. So you drum up some business on what would ordinarily be a slow night, and you provide a service that is a place where people with their pets can get together and interact with one another.
There definitely seems to be a diminishing sense, and maybe it is because of all this grooming that we're doing, that animals are dirty, that having them, you know, there while we're eating dinner at a cafe somewhere is a problem.
You know, that's such a good point. I don't mean to suggest in this book that the kind of phenomena I'm writing about are everywhere. What strikes me is that they are increasingly prevalent, even among people like you or me who don't quite fashion themselves crazy over-the-top pet people. But there are still lots of places in the country where this stuff doesn't apply. And I remember reading a sociologist's essay about a kind of northeastern big city neighborhood in transition. It was sort of gentrifying a little bit. It had an old-time blue-collar, mostly African-American population, and these sort of white yuppies who had just arrived. And one of the places where the kind of cultural differences between the newcomers and the older population was in pets. And these the older line population, the people who were interviewed, would talk about how disgusting they thought it was that these yuppies would sort of get on their knees in front of their dogs and let the dogs lick them in the face and so on. And people thought that was just so gross. I mean, these are animals that eat out of the trash. And, you know, what do you say to that? What we think is disgusting and what we think is not disgusting is to some extent culturally determined. And it really does show how far we've come, I think, from agriculture, from the farm, and towards thinking of pets as kind of indoor household family type animals, that we are less focused on how gross they are.
Michael Schaefer is my guest. His new book is called One Nation Under Dog: Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. We'll return to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. We would ask that first you call our other key number of this week, 1-800-456-5372. That is the number to call to join our spring membership campaign. And Jeff Whittington, senior producer of Think, is here now to talk about it as well.
Hey, Chris. We are doing well on the drive. We started on Friday. Today's the first full day of the membership campaign, and we've reached about $76,000 raised so far. So thanks very, very much to everybody who has called 1-800-456-5372, who has gone online to KERA.org. You're making this happen one contribution at a time. And I would say if you joined last spring or you renewed last spring, it's time for you to renew again. And we know that thousands of you joined the station last spring during the spring 2008 drive. So why not go ahead and do that today? Take care of that renewal today, and it will catapult us that much farther to the end of this membership campaign, and things can get back to normal very quickly.
We do our very best here at KERA to keep our expenses down because we are well aware that it's your money that supports us. 56% of the money that we need to run the station comes from listeners like you. The rest comes from a mixture of corporate support, and we do get a little bit of government money. money, but the majority of it comes from you, and we're really careful about that, which is why we raise only the amount of money that we need here. We don't sort of stay on the air hoping for, you know, extra cash. We plan out our budget very carefully, and then we come to you as honestly and forthrightly as we can and say, rather than running a bunch of very obvious commercials, we are going to just ask you for the money to keep your favorite station strong. You can support this effort by calling 1-800-456-5372. If you would like to have a copy of Michael's book, which is not only really interesting, and not only will you probably see yourself or people you know in it, but it's funny as well, in a good way. And we would love to be able to offer that to you with our compliments when you make a $120 contribution.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. The email, the web address, rather, is kera.org. Just click on the support banner at the top of the front page, and you can follow the lead of folks like Kat Sabi in Louisville, Constance Richardson in Fort Worth. We also heard from Lauren Murphy in Denton. Thanks so much, Lauren. And thanks to John Cross in Dallas as well for getting on board during this hour. It's so quick and easy. If you go online and make your contribution, you can look at all the different thank you gifts that are available. And, you know, you can get through the whole process in about 2 minutes. It's very easy to do. Safe, secure way to support your public radio station, KERA.
I tend to be a horrible procrastinator with things like this. I always think, well, it's going to take too much time. It is great when you take that 2 minutes to either go online or make the phone call. You're done with it. You can check it off your list. It feels great. And you know that you have supported an institution that exists within the community. Everybody who runs the place works right here. We work for you and with you. And we feel as invested in this as you are. But we need your dollars to make it happen. And they are a huge benefit, not just to the programming that you listen to, but to the station as a whole and to all of North Texas.
1-800-456-5372. Online at KERA.org. We've talked a little bit today about the Unwigged and Unplugged concert. Christopher Guest, Michael McKeon, and Harry Shearer are going to be performing songs from This Is Spinal Tap and A Mighty Wind. There are tickets available at the $150 membership level on a credit card. If you call 800-456-5372, you can get all the details. But please be the next one right now to call or to go online and pledge at kera.org.
That's right. You can make your contribution. And you can pay for it in a variety of different ways. Certain thank you gifts you have to pay with a credit or debit card. But otherwise, you can set up a sustaining membership, which is like an automatic debit from your checking account every month. Or you can write a check if that's the way you like to do things. We do ask that you give us a call, though. 1-800-456-5372. If you want a copy of Michael Schaefer's book, or if you've heard about any thank you gift that you are still interested in, ask the volunteer on the phone or check it out online. We are here ready to talk to you. 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Michael Schaefer. His new book is called One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Let's go to Jan in Dallas. Hello, Jan.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment and see what your guest had to say about it. I went to a dog photographer here in town to have a formal portrait sitting done of my dog that has since died and then of my current pet, and I showed the results of that portrait sitting to one of my coworkers, and they kind of looked at me and said, my word, this is more than most people are ever going to spend on their children, much less a dog. And I guess I was a little bit taken aback by it because, unlike some people, I don't consider myself an over-the-top pet person. I certainly have never dressed either of my pets in costume and stuff, but, you know, I just wanted decent pictures of them.
Yeah,
well, kind of curious as to what he'd say.
You're definitely not alone, Jen. What do you think, Michael?
Well, first of all, a lot, yeah, that's a pretty common expense people rack up nowadays. And look at, I mean, just from a very practical point of view, it's hard to take pictures of pets. It's really hard to take pictures of dogs. They move, they jump. They don't look at the camera. Even taking my author picture, I took a picture with my St. Bernard. That was hard. We have a photographer friend. He's a news reporter, a photojournalist, and he was in front of me with the camera, and my wife was kind of behind him, holding a big block of cream cheese over his head, so the dog would look at the cream cheese. It's not easy. So you know, you wanted a picture to remember your dog. The photographer wasn't ripping you off because I think that's a tougher job than photographing a child, even though that's not a particularly easy photo task either. So. But, you know, I think I was struck by one of the other things you said, which was that what your coworker said sort of bothered you because you had never thought of yourself as a over-the-top pet person. And I think we've kind of established this bogeyman of over-the-top pet person. None of us want to be that person because it seems so superficial and frivolous and ridiculous. But I think if you just think of the things you do, you had pets. You cared about your pets. You wanted to remember them with a nice picture. You knew, as we all do, that they aren't going to be around forever. That's enough, and that doesn't seem like a bad thing to me. It's not as if you had been about to give a whole bunch of money to the Salvation Army when at the last minute you changed your mind and decided to get a pet picture. You know, people who do nice things about their pets, it's not like they would otherwise have given the money to charity. They typically are cutting it out of their vacation budget or out of their going out to dinner budget or whatever. So I think for whatever reason, this is a subject that people really feel emotional about, and there's always a touch of guilt involved. And I think we just there are, like with anything, there are lots of dumb, frivolous, selfish things you can do for your pets. I don't think getting a picture taken is one of them.
Yeah, we should say you do not agree with the argument that some people will make that all this spending on our pets is sort of responsible for other social problems, because it's not like this either or. Either we spend $43 billion on our pets or we fix the schools.
Look, we're a consumer society, for better or for worse. And it's if you spend, you know, $5,000 on a flat screen TV, well, people will say, gee, you know, maybe Chris likes movies, or you know, maybe she's into high tech or whatever, and it's fine. And if you spend the same amount of money on some year of very expensive pet food or some kind of surgery, you're liable to get a lecture from someone who says, well, gee, don't you know how many people in the Congo don't have any medical care whatsoever? And that's true, but it's kind of a false choice. Because you know you've spent this money on your pet that was out of your consumer budget, and you would have spent it probably on yourself otherwise. And just as I don't think anyone should go around patting themselves on the back and saying, "Gee, I'm a great guy because I paid for a crucial surgery for my pet." At the same time, I don't think they should really go around beating themselves up either. I think you know there are enough things that we all spend money on and spend time on that are actually kind of wasteful and useless and selfish that we should feel bad about without having to get into feeling bad because we took care of an animal that needed us.
Let's go next to Amanda in Fort Worth. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I was calling about cats. It seems like when people use the word pets, they're usually talking about dogs. And I've got a few theories on this because I'm kind of an all-animal person, but I really do love cats. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's like the litter box thing or people think that cats can't be trained, or why does it seem? What is with the cat bias?
In my book, I'm really, really trying to look at kind of the ways people spend time and money on their pets. And with dogs, there are a lot more variables. You know, if you go away for a couple days, you can leave the cat in the house and have someone look in on them. But dogs need a lot more sort of. The dogs can't be left as long. You are going to hire, a lot of people hire trainers for their dogs now. I mean, this is not just something you do if you want to have a stunt dog, but it's kind of in a lot of places like sending your teenage kid to driver's ed or something. It's just sort of a normal, responsible thing people do, and that's not really part of the and I have a cat too, by the way. That's not really part of the cat person's bag of needs. So since I was writing about how it came to be that in 15 years, the amount Americans spend on pets has nearly tripled to $45 billion as projected for this year. A lot of that had to do with dogs, so that was part of the focus. But, you know, in my book, I write about cat food and about lawsuits over wrongful deaths of cats and people saying, hey, this cat is a member of my family. I love this cat. And when you go, someone has caused its death, when I go to court, they tell me, no, that cat was just a piece of property. And in fact, it was a piece of property that was worth only the $75 you paid to adopt it from the ASPCA. People feel like that's very unfair and are kind of agitating about that. And it's sort of another way that the way we treat pets kind of reflects our society, which is really one of the things I'm getting at in this book. So there's plenty on cats in my book, and I think there's plenty on cats in the pet world, too. It's just so much of the stuff that happens outdoors happens with dogs because so many cats just live indoors.
So at least since the second Roosevelt administration, we have followed as a nation the pets of the presidents.
Right.
But it does seem that the Obama's hunt for a dog has been, I hate to keep using the phrase, but over the top. We've never been so obsessed.
You know, I think that you can go well before FDR. People in positions of power have always had pets. And you know, before democracy, before the United States, these tended to be, it was sort of the exact opposite of what's going on with the Obamas. The various Chinese emperors and Mary, Queen of Scots, had pets that were treated lavishly. And Mary, Queen of Scots, was always followed by this herd of lapdogs that were dressed in crushed blue velvet outfits. And this was at a time when a lot of her citizens, you know, could barely afford to dress themselves, much less spend a lot of money outfitting their dogs. And it was sort of held up as yet another way that the queen was different from normal people. And, you know, look at her. She's so great. She can afford to do this. She travels with these fancy dogs. In this country, in a democracy, it's sort of the exact opposite. And if you take someone like Obama, who is the most powerful person in the world, the most famous person in the world, a celebrity, a guy whose life is unimaginably different from yours or mine, but when he's out there frolicking and being a dad with a couple little girls who love their puppy, he's just like everyone else. And I think for politicians in this country, in a democracy, there's a real need to have to sort of showcase these moments where, look, the president's just like you and me.
So with the way we all treat our pets these days, have we moved the bar on what's extreme to people like Paris Hilton and Leona Helmsley?
I think so. I mean, I think things that now happen kind of as a matter of course that are sort of basic middle class things didn't used to happen. I mean, the veterinary profession used to be, you know, rabies shots and deworming and maybe the occasional broken leg being fixed, and that was kind of it. And now, I mean, there's a market that goes well beyond Leona Helmsley and Paris Hilton for very high-end, really cool-looking surgeries. There are enough people seeking out doggy daycare, you know, don't you call it a kennel because they'll get mad at you, that there are these very fancy doggy hotels and or they call them doggy day spas in some places in nearly every American city and in a lot of smaller towns too. I mean, I went to one in San Francisco that was for the most expensive room. There was furniture, there was art on the wall, there was a TV that the dog could watch. There was even a little webcam aimed at where the dog slept, where the dog's owner, presumably on vacation someplace, could log on and look at a picture of their dog at that very moment. And the people who worked there told me they got calls a lot from people who would say, well, you know, the dog looks a little bored. Could you send up some treats? and they would send it up and call it room service. You know, this is stuff where, I mean, that's not something everybody does, but enough people do it that there's now a pretty big market for it.
Really?
The number of professional dog walkers is now big enough that the federal government has a specific labor statistics number for those people. It tripled between 2000 and 2006. And I think if you look at it, you know, it seems on the one hand like, what the heck is wrong with us as a people? We can't even walk our dogs anymore. We have to pay someone to do it. But then I say in my book that if you were like an anthropologist from Mars and you just showed up and you had nothing to go on other than the contents of a PetSmart, you could learn a great deal about our human society that had nothing to do with pets. And this is one of the things. In a time when most dogs lived with a family that had a homemaker, they didn't need a professional walker. Nowadays, we have two career couples, and we Americans work really long hours. We got a lot of latchkey dogs, just like we got a lot of latchkey kids. And it's only inevitable that in our dynamic economy, a profession would spring up to deal with that.
Michael Schaefer's new book is called One Nation Under Dog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac-Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. Michael, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to all of you who are supporting KERA this afternoon with contributions by calling 1-800-456-5372. You can also go to the website, kera.org, and click on the support button. You can receive a copy of Michael Schaefer's book. It's available as a thank you gift at the $120 or above contribution level. And Jeff, we have had a lot of success so far in our spring fundraising campaign.
We have. We heard from many of you. Thank you so much. If you've joined the station, if you've gone online to kera.org, if you've called 800-456-5372 in the last few days to support your public radio station. But if you haven't, we're still waiting to hear from you. If you joined the station, if you renewed your membership last spring, we know there were thousands of you who got on board during the membership campaign. Well, it's time to renew again. And it's really, this is your opportunity to take care of this. If you take care of it earlier in the drive, and not wait till, you know, it's frantic and it's day, I don't know, 9 or 10 or something like that. The sooner we can get you back on board and get this business taken care of, the sooner we can wrap this membership campaign up. And if this book as a thank you gift is something that you would like, you know what? If you're not buying the book, of course, we always say you could send the station $100 and go down to your local retailer or online retailer and get Michael Schaefer's book. We would encourage you to do that, but we would really encourage you to join the station.
The telephone number to call is 1-800-456-5372. You can go online to kera.org. You know, if you've not been a member before, you might say to yourself, well, what, aside from the thank you gifts, what changes if I become a member of KERA? And here's the truth. Nothing changes. The station is able to continue bringing you the high-quality programming that we know that you rely on, that you come to every single day. What doesn't change is our ability to provide the best programming, we think, in North Texas. Public radio exists because we all believe it should exist, and we take action. It's not enough in a system like this just to listen, because we also need member support to make the station possible. 56% of the money it takes to run the station comes from listeners just like you. Some of you can give us $10,000. Some of you can give us $50 or anywhere in between or above or below those amounts. You make that decision. But it is important that you call 1-800-456-5372.
You've already chosen to listen to KERA, and we know that more and more of you are listening all the time. I just heard from Jeff Ramirez, our vice president for radio this morning, that KERA surpassed the 400,000 listeners per week mark not too long ago. And, you know, about I've seen statistics are a little over 10,000 people a month move to North Texas. So we know you're coming to KERA as maybe a new listener. Maybe you've moved from another public radio station, another market in the country. Well, this is your public radio station now. And we really hope that you will take this opportunity to call 800-456-KERA to go online to kera.org and support it.
Thanks to Diana Cavazos in Fort Worth, Rajiv Matthew in Flower Mound, Krista Tartoni in Dallas, and Nina Bradstreet in Richardson, and all of you who are joining right now. We also want to mention that a lot of you, we know, sort of time-delayed this show, think and listen to it on podcast, and some of you are from the North Texas area, but we also know there are people all over the world. If you make a contribution right now, your money absolutely goes to support production of this show and the station as a whole, and you know, we all are sort of interrelated parts here. But we absolutely would really appreciate a contribution at any time of day. Whether you're listening to this sort of next Tuesday at 9 p.m., there are still people on the phones available to take your call. We would very much appreciate a contribution at whatever level works for you.
1-800-456-5372 is the number to call. We have heard from several of you who listen to the podcast over the last couple of years who have supported the station, have supported KERA because of the podcast, and we thank you very much for that. And we hear from you all over the world who listen to our podcast, so thanks so much for tuning in, for downloading our audio, and subscribing to the podcast. But, you know, it's everybody's content here. It's produced for you, no matter who you are, where you live. The station answers really only to you, the listener, the person who uses the content. So we're coming directly to you and saying, you know, why not throw a few dollars this direction. It is your public radio station, KERA, and we do ask that you call 800-456-5372.
And it is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, and online at kera.org, K261 CW100.1 in Tyler, K202 DR88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV99.3 in Sherman.
And no matter where you listen, you're getting KERA, you're getting KERA-produced content. And if you listen to The Think Show, we would really appreciate your support during the show at 1-800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. There is a banner across the very front page.
You can't miss it.
Where you see the win a trip to London. And you click on that, it takes you right to the support page for KERA. And it's very, very easy, very safe, very secure. And you'll be in and out of the website in about 2 minutes. And we'll see immediately that your contribution has come in. And we can add that to the over $78,000 that's been raised already since Friday morning in support of KERA.
Yeah, and the fun thing about the support page now and the banner on the top of the website is that you can actually follow our progress, because there's a little icon that will let you know how far we have come and you have come in helping us to support our goal, to reach our goal. Again, our telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. That's 456-KERA, or you can go online to kera.org. Thank you.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.